the island. She fell in love with a Sicilian, and she's been here ever since. So this is somebody who really knows this island and this culture very, very well. She's the author of the famous book On Persephone's Island, which is one of the most well-known, if the most, not the most well-known book written by an American about coming here and integrating and understanding and loving the local Sicilian culture. She's also the author of another book. She wrote another book on Frederick II's mother, you know, the one who gave birth to Frederick in a tent in a public square to prove that she was the genuine mother. And she's also the author of another few books, Pomp and Sustenance and Bitter Almonds, which are about Sicilian cuisine, aren't they? So this is what we're going to conclude with in terms of presentations. Food and festivities, and how that aspect of Sicilian life continues this ancient heritage that we have been learning about over the past week. So let's welcome Mary Telson.
Fail to point out that Mary is Pamela Morton's sister.
Yeah. And I'm very happy to be here. I thank you for inviting me. Unfortunately, I couldn't come for the whole conference. I wish I had been here. So I want to apologize in advance if I'm repeating anything that you've had from the other presenters. I have to say at the outset that I am going to be telling you about things I'm going to talk a little bit about Greek festivals, classical Greek festivals, and then I'm going to show you some elements of the present-day Sicilian festivals. And I'll leave you to draw the connections, because it is not possible, certainly for someone who has no academic credentials, but in general, I don't think it's possible to say this descends from that. But there are some things that are clearly more than coincidences. And it's a great deal of fun. Going to be a light note on which to end the seminar. It's fun to think that these connections really do exist. And if I do speculate, I'm not the first one to do so. In 1820, a British naval officer who was surveying the coastlines for the British Navy, Sicilian coastlines, wrote, "It is strikingly singular that so many peculiarities of the ancients, domestic, civil, and religious, should remain in force in this island, notwithstanding its frequent changes of masters, and that such strong similitude should still be observable in the details of the table." I think it wasn't all that surprising, or isn't all that surprising, that that is where you can see the most connections. Of all the human activities, the production and consumption of food is most essential for our survival, both as individuals and as a species. And it's also, and I think sometimes unfortunately for Americans, it's hard to remember this, but food is essential to our sense of community and to ourselves. I think the ethnic groups in America have held on to their culinary traditions as a statement of their identity as much as just a question of what they like to eat. And I think one of the tragedies of modern American life is that people have become so divorced from where their food comes from and why they're eating it when they're eating it. That it's very alienating not to have these connections. But just for this reason, we tend to be very conservative about what we eat and the rights with which we eat it. especially about small children. They're very reluctant to try something new. The most interesting chef operating today in Sicily, a man named Pino Pugliaia, has a restaurant that has two or three Michelin stars in Licata. And he uses high-tech, sous vide, all the things. But what he's interested in is using this modern apparatus to recreate the smells and the flavors that he remembers from his grandmother's kitchen. That's what he's doing with it. My favorite example of this, I will, is this funny? Harry, where am I?
Yeah, we're getting it right up for you right now.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm going to read a short piece of poetry to you. A practiced job he made of it, giving each ewe her suckling, thickened his milk then into curds and whey. Sift out the curds to drip in withy baskets, and poured the whey to stand in bowls, cooling until he drank it for his supper. We're talking about ricotta here, a cheese that I imagine most of you know from, if nothing else, from cannoli, which the famous Sicilian pastry. I've got it here, I don't have to turn around. This is a shepherd today making ricotta in Sicily. And these are the withy baskets that were used to drain the cheese up until just a few years ago when the European Union imposed plastic upon us for hygienic, but certainly not for aesthetic reasons. The thing about it is that the shepherd that the poem is talking about is this guy here, Polyphemus. The cyclops that you've been hearing about, I think, in other lectures. The one-eyed cyclops that dwelt at that lived at the foot of Etna and whose single eye, here they gave him three and not just one. Usually he's depicted with one. This is from the mosaics in Piazza Armerina, the Roman villa in Piazza Armerina here in Sicily. His single eye is thought to be a representation of the crater of the volcano. So the shepherd in the poem was Polyphemus, and the author of the poem was Homer. Basically, the Sicilian cheese that Homer writes about, which then in the classical period became famous throughout the classical world. Aristophanes talks about a dog stealing a Sicilian cheese in one of his comedies, were made in exactly the same way that Sicilian shepherds are still making cheeses today, with the exception of plastic instead of withy baskets. So, I think that, though there are actually many, many foods in the Sicilian cuisine that can be traced back, that have names that come from the Greek, one of the famous cookies here, the biscuits, is Coulureddo, which comes from colura, which is a Greek word for cake or focaccia. There's something there's a superimposition there that's not supposed to be there. We'll see what happens with the next one. How did that get? So there are a lot of foods on the Sicilian table that you can probably say came in with the Greeks, and basically the fundamental ingredients of the Mediterranean diet haven't changed for 3,000 years. We get the things coming in later years, adding to a basis which is very, very old. It's older than 3,000, it's more like 10,000, 12,000 years. So if we're conservative about what we eat every day, think how much more we're going to be conservative about anything to do with food and rights that has sacred meaning to us, and how much more reluctant we're going to be to change anything, any kind of right that has kept the harvests coming in the past. We're going to hold on to those things, as I hope to show you. So the first thing, let's see what happens now. The first thing, this is from the Archaeological Museum here in Syracuse. It's a nice, might have been a tomb thing. I don't know exactly what its purpose was. But anyway, feasting is very important in the classical Greek world. For the Homer talks a lot about roasting meat, and feasting for the archaic Greek aristocracy was a major status statement. You invited your friends to share a big meal with you, and that was how you got status, and therefore you got hangers-on who would go to take up arms in your help. And of course, this kind of a more rustic feast gave way to the symposium. And this is probably a Roman symposium, but anyway, the Romans followed the Greek model in this. And the symposium was in Greece, was extremely, in mainland Greece, was a very prescribed menu, followed a very precise sequence of courses, and the intellectual activity was, theoretically at least, as important as the food that they were consuming. Even the religious sacrifices to the Olympian gods were feasts. The burnt sacrifices was cheerful tendance, as Jane Harrison puts it, cheerful tendance to the Olympian gods, who were anthropomorphic gods. And actually, the mortals joined in the feast and shared the feast and got the better end of the stick, because all the gods got was some greasy smoke ascending to heaven, and the mortals got to eat the meat. So it was very basic to the whole Greek food. Was very important to the Greeks on all these different levels. And I must say that this kind of sacrifice to the Olympian gods is quite a late development in Greek history. In preparing this talk, I've leaned heavily on Jane Ellen Harrison, who was a British linguist and scholar. Who I agree. who was a real pioneer, and in 1903 published a book called Prolegomenon to the Study of Greek Religion. And her basic thesis is in studying all the various rites and rituals of Greek religion, is a division between what she calls the rites of attendance, this cheerful tendance to the Olympian gods, and the rites of aversion, which characterized a deeper, older, and more persistent religious feeling. Of the latter, she says, the formula of that religion was not do ut des, I give that you may give, but do ut abias, I give that you may go away and keep away. The beings that were worshipped were not rational, human, law-abiding gods, but vague, irrational, mainly malevolent daemones, spirit things, ghosts, boogies, and the like. So there was this substratum of what's called chthonic, underworld, spirit gods, ghosts, that had to be appeased. And then the Olympian gods were imposed on top of that. But for the man in the street, the appeasement of ghosts, and of snake gods, and of boogeymen was a constant right through the classical period. Harrison examined some of the major festivals and held nominally in honor of the Olympians, and finds that they have little or nothing to do with the particular Olympian to whom they are supposed to be addressed, that they are not in the main rites of burnt sacrifice, of joy and feasting, an agonistic contest, but rites of a gloomy underworld character, connected mainly with purification and the worship of ghosts. Whether or not you accept her thesis, her description of the Greek rites, and she concentrates on the Athenian festivals, are based on literary sources and on tombs, on vase paintings, and so they're, I think, not, of course she does interpret at a certain point, but I think they can be taken as valid. So, as I said, I wanted to go through a few of these rites that she discovers, because I think we can see connections, resonances. I like the idea of it being echo rather than connection, and then and everybody can fill up the interval as they see. Because they share the same climate, one of the cool wet winters and hot and extremely dry summers, and the same latitude, the Greek and the Sicilian agricultural situation is very much the same. They follow the same year, the same calendar. The major difference in the agriculture between the two countries is that of fertility. Greek soil, the topsoil in Greece was very thin and of poor quality. And Greece was already badly deforested by the fall of the Mycenaean civilization at the end of the second millennium. So, and then after the Mycenaean civilization falls, there was a period of dark ages. And then, in the 8th century, when it began to get back on its feet, and I'm talking about the 8th century BC, there was a population explosion. In Attica, the population has been estimated to have increased by 6 times. So there was, agriculture was not able to feed the Greeks in Greece. And one of the major factors in the whole colonization of migration was the need to have more food. And Sicily, on the other hand, is extremely fertile. It always has been, partly because it's volcanic, but partly because it has had record yields for a long, through the century. When the Greeks got here, they found an abundance that they'd never known, and it changes a lot of things. The first cookbook in the Western world, and the first school for professional cooks were founded in Syracuse, came to be in Syracuse in the 5th and 4th centuries BC. And right through until the fall of the Roman Empire, the Sicilian chef was the equivalent of the 19th century Parisian chef. It was what you wanted in Europe. The Golden Mean had a hard time with his abundance. I sort of fell by the way. And Plato wrote home that he was really disgusted the way that Syracuse and people stuffed themselves. But anyway. So in both cultures, the agrarian year, the calendar year, begins in October. The harvests of the previous year are all in the wheat, the grapes. Olives are a little later, but olives were not an important, they came quite late to Greek culture, and olives were not a principal source of nourishment. You needed the wheat to survive, or the barley as it was in Greece. So in October, at the start of the rainy season, the fields are plowed, ready for sowing, and ready for both the legumes and the wheat to be the grains to be sown. So that, and this year opens with something called this I apologize in advance for my Greek pronunciation, which is non-existent, so I'm pretending it's Italian. The thesmophoria, the most ancient of the Greek rituals, which was basically getting fields ready to be sown. It was the exclusive domain of women, and so the literary sources that we have, from which we get descriptions of it, were all written by men, and they are a little bit contradictory. But basically, they concur in describing a three-day festival, 3 day in Athens, 10 day in Syracuse, in favor of Demeter. Demeter is the goddess of agriculture, as you know. She is the person who gives the wheat to Triptolemus, puts him on a winged chariot, and sends him out to teach mankind how to cultivate wheat. She was also the goddess of legitimate marriage, and the thesmophoria were only married matrons could take place in. Ladies of Athens camped out near a chasm or rupture in the ground, into which on the first day they threw pine cones, which even since prehistoric times, I believe, have been a symbol of fertility, because there's so many seeds in them. And pigs. The pig here is this is also from the museum in here in Syracuse. This is Demeter holding a pig. The pig was supposed to represent Persephone, theoretically. Anyway, on the first day, they threw the pigs and the pine cones into the chasm. On the second day, they fasted. They lay on mats made of animals casted branches, the chaste tree branches. On the third day, the rotting flesh of the pigs, clearly not the pigs they'd thrown 2 days before, whether they were the previous year pigs or there was another festival a few months beforehand, but anyway, there was rotted pig flesh was brought up from the chasm, mixed with grain, and this mixture was strewn on the fields to ensure its fertility. Syracuse in Sicily, where Demeter was of extreme importance. It was a very important festival, and there was a special kind of cake made called a miloi. It was sesame, honey, and flour, and they were made in the shape of female genitals, and they were offered to the gods. Theoretically, according to Harrison, the throwing of the pigs into the chasm was originally intended to be an appeasement of the snake gods that lived in the underworld gods, and then the Demeter and Persephone made was imposed upon this afterwards. The next festival, there's a lady throwing a pig into the chasm. And she seems to be holding a plate with some sort of offering in it. The next festival was the Pienexia, which was held in the honor of Apollo, the departing sun god, and celebrating the sowing, the actual putting of the grain under the soil.
Could you kindly say that word again?
Pienexia, Pyanepsia. Two elements of this feast, both of which are repeated in the spring when the sun returns, are relevant to us. The preparation of a boiled porridge, called either pienepsia or panspermia, all seeds in panspermia, it must be the Latin. But it was all that remained of the harvest of the previous year, which was made into a porridge and offered to the god, and of course eaten by the people who were. Who were worshiping. And there was another element, which was the aireazione, which in Pausanias' words was a branch of olive twined with wool and having hanging from it various fruits of the earth. A boy, both of whose parents are alive, carries it forth and places it in front of the doors of Apollo's sanctuary. Remember these various things because I'm pointing them out because we'll see an echo of them. February, the Greeks celebrated the Anthestadia, ostensibly a festival in honor of Dionysus, to celebrate the opening of the casks and the drinking of the new wine. It survived into the Roman calendars, the Lupercalia, a festival of drinking and bawdy licentious behavior. Although Harrison sees it originally as a rite of appeasement, of evoking and then banishing the ancestral ghosts. And there are also, in accompaniment with that, other minor festivals that are concomitant to the including one in honor of Zeus Mentilius. Zeus, the easygoing one, the kindly one, who was a development, who was an evolution from Zeus Maimastus, the winter god, the stormy god, the snake god, the underworld god, the angry Zeus, who required bird sacrifices of whole beasts, not just a few pieces of fat and bones to make some good-smelling smoke, but whole beasts which had to be sacrificed. And as these feast festivals evolved, especially for poorer people, the whole beasts became substituted with cakes or loaves of bread that were fashioned in the shape of the beasts that were once sacrificed. Then in late May, early June, there's a series of festivals, the Thargadian, which is basically a harvest festival. The offering of the first fruits, be they bread, fruit, and vegetables. Once again, it was sacred to Apollo, but had other concomitant festivals.
Would you say that name more slowly again, please?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thargadia. Thargelia.
Thank you.
The last festival of the year, there were obvious, just as there are different patron saints in every village in Sicily that are celebrated throughout the year by the people of the village. The Greek world had lots of minor festivals. I'm talking about the big ones and the ones we know about because, of course, a lot of them have disappeared into the clouds of time. The last festival that Harrison doesn't speak of at all, and I don't know why she didn't talk about it, was the festival of called the Adone, A-D-O-N-E. We have a description of it from Aristophanes in his comedy Lysistrata. These women, have they made din enough, I wonder, with their tambourines? But wept Adonis enough upon their terraces? I was listening to the speeches last assembly day, and Demostratus, having confounded, was saying we must all go over to Sicily. And lo, his wife was dancing around, repeating, alas, alas, Adonis, woe is me, for Adonis. Demostratus was saying we must levy hoplites, and there was his wife, more than half drunk, screaming on the housetop, weep, weep for Adonis. Did I blush, you women, for your wild and uproarious doings? So mid-July, the women of Athens, both respectable matrons and courtesans, in an odd mixture of bawdy behavior and noisy grieving, mourned the death of Adonis, the beautiful youth beloved of Aphrodite, who, while hunting, was fatally wounded by a boar. One of the most curious elements of this festival was the preparation of an offering to Adonis in the form of a so-called garden. We have Aphrodite with Adonis and a care, a winged angel, bearing the garden in a plate. The garden was a pot which was seeded and placed on the terraces as near to the sun as possible. In the midsummer heat, the plants germinated, ripened, and withered prematurely. 8 days of barren vegetation, as opposed to the 8 months required for fruitful ripening of the crops. A symbol of a young man cut down in his prime. Marcel Detienne has made a very detailed study of these gardens according to the principles of structural anthropology. But for our purposes, it is sufficient to note that 4 different seeds were placed in the pots. Wheat, barley, lettuce, and fennel. Not the bulb fennel we eat today, or we know today, which the Greeks didn't have, but the wild fennel, which goes everywhere in Sicily, and which, according to classical Greek medicine, was beneficial to the genital organs and to the abundant production of sperm. So, that's the Greek year. Now we will pass to the Sicilian year, present day year. But I have to point out at the beginning that we must take into account here practice of the early Christian church, the syncretism, the deliberate co-opting of pagan festivals and giving them a Christian significance, so as to keep people happy that they could keep their rituals, is basically what it. They didn't have to, they had to leave their gods, but they could do the same things, pay the same kinds of tribute, but to the Christian God. And not all of these festivals were necessarily Greek festivals that the church took over. In fact, the first festival in the Sicilian year is that of what's now called All Souls' Day, the Feast of the Dead, which was not a Greek. I mean, there was plenty of appeasing and banishing the ghosts of the dead. But the commemoration and celebration of the dead was actually Celtic. It was a Celtic festival honoring the souls of dead heroes. It was a form of ancestral hero worship. And it was the Cistercian monks in the 12th century who decided to make this into a Christian festival honoring all the dead. Why should a Celtic festival become so important in Sicily? Basically, I think, I borrow words from an Italian medievalist, Franco Cardini. In October, the sowing of the wheat begins, and November honors that which lies beneath the ground, awaiting rebirth. The dead return in a ritual visit to the living, just as the living celebrate the cult of the dead. And the whole period between the beginning of November and Epiphany is a temple study dinner in which the gaze to the afterworld remain open. In Sicily, the gaze of the ancestors are not evil spirits to be placated or banished, but they're to be honored and remembered. Although it is odd, I think what John was talking yesterday about that the use of mourning in Sicily, which is dying out, but the woman in the long black shawl was a stereotype of Sicily for a long time. And that was actually a Greek custom. But it was not mourning, it was hiding. You were hiding from, you put on a veil or a shawl, hide yourself from the ghost of the newly dead. That's been totally inverted. Nowadays, on the Day of the Dead, Imort, they very familiarly called Imort, the dead. What are you doing for the dead this year? It's usually a long weekend. The ghosts of their ancestors come back and bring presents to the children. The presents that have been bought at the fair of the dead. This is another picture of the old lady of Athens, not a goddess, climbing down from her terrace and offering the garden of Adonis to Adonis. Now, so this is, I've just put a few titles up, mostly with place names so that you could see them, but anyway. This is the Fair of the Dead. These are the man is selling candy, he's selling sugar statues, which are traditional, and what I love about this is that it's a very living tradition, so that the traditional knights, paladins, and dancers have been joined by soccer players, so they're Mickey Mouse, Superman, it goes on. And the frutta di maturana, the unpaced fruit that Sicily so famous for, was made only in this period and was one of the things that the ancestors brought to the children. And I think it's an amusing inversion of these. These are figs of terracotta. They were a tomb offering, and they're here in the archaeological museum in Syracuse. Anyway. The next important festivity is St. Lucy's Day, which falls on the 13th of December, which in the old Julian calendar was the winter solstice. And St. Lucy, we think of her as sort of a Swedish saint with a crown of candles, but actually she's a virgin martyr. If she actually existed, she was a virgin martyr born in Syracuse. She's the patron saint of this city. And she plucked her eyes out rather than be given in marriage to a pagan king. And she is patroness of eyesight and of light. She's the promise that in the darkest day of the year, the shortest amount of daylight, there will be a return to sunlight and a rebirth of spring. And all over Sicily, she's celebrated with a ritual dish known as cuccia. A porridge of whole wheat berries, which is in more rural areas, is sweetened with cinnamon and boiled down grape must be called tough. This is the rural cuccia. I apologize for the two photographs of cuccia which are overloaded with presentation. That was the only photographs I could find there. And it gets much fancier in the big cities. Palermo, they put ricotta cream on it. For the book, I think, but or blanc mange, and this is the only wheat that gets beaten on 13th of December. There is there are various stories out for this. One of the most common is that in a time of dire famine, the saint on the 13th of December ships their wheat to the harbors of Sicily, and the starving populace boil the wheat up and made cuccia rather than wait for it to be milled. But in any case, Sicilians eat neither pasta nor bread on St. Lucy's Day. All the earlier harvests being served up as a ritual dish on the darkest day of the year. It seems to me that this is a very clear example of syncretism, just capturing a rite and giving it a whole new mythology. St. Lucy just about exhausts Sicily's involvement with the winter solstice, which in this climate is not all that important. There are no echoes of the darker rites in Nordic mythology, no old kings put to death. The Greeks celebrated Zeus Maimactes, the raging one, god of winter storms, that according to Jane Harrison, evolved as a benevolent form of the snake god. But I know of no resonances with this unless, I'm just playing here. One of the mandatory dishes on Christmas Eve used to be, I don't think it's true anymore, used to be eel. And if eel was expensive, and for the poorer classes, it was okay if they got a marzipan eel instead of a real one, which does make you think that maybe they were beating some snake, I don't know. But anyway, that's just fun. Christmas is not, it was a very private family affair here. It's never been a major festival in Sicily. I mean, and now it's become a commercial festival. We have Christmas trees and all the rest, but still, it's nothing that's truly Sicilian in import. The next thing is carnival, body drinking, dressing up, inversion of the social order, but it's such a clear descent of the Roman Lupercalia and the end of Syria, but it's not really worth going into in detail. The two most important festivals of the Sicilian spring are Easter and St. Joseph's Day, neither of which coincide in day with the festivals of the Greek calendar. Easter, of course, depends on the lunar calendar of the Jewish Passover, and the Feast of St. Joseph is a very late addition to the Christian calendar. In the early and medieval church, St. Joseph was a very insignificant figure. He's shown in pictures of the Nativity and of the flight into Egypt, but he's almost never portrayed by himself. It wasn't until the Counter-Reformation in the 16th century that the Jesuits, upset by the excessive attention that the Madonna was getting, decided they had to balance the picture and create a cult around a male saint. The choice of March 19th, which falls midway between the spring equinox and the ancient Roman festival of the Liberalia, cannot have been a mere coincidence. The Liberalia celebrated Liber, the patron god of the Roman plebeians, and as well as the god of winemaking. And surely the Jesuits were determined to arm their new hero with the residues of the ancient festivals of fertility and social justice. The Feast of St. Joseph became a ritual feeding of the poor, taking place at a time when nothing was left of the previous year's harvests, and in centuries in which famine was a very real and frequent occurrence. My husband can remember being taken as a small child to watch as the poor of his town, Bergamo, were fed, and they set up big truckle tables in the main square. The poor were given an abundant meal, and the middle class people stood around and watched. Oh. And he hated it. He was embarrassed by it. Nowadays, it's changed. A deal of it's a little bit less poverty and more sensitivity. But the poor are no longer present. I can remember the last professional San Giuseppe Paro. He was a man who, an old man who made his spring money by enacting Saint Joseph at these festivals. But today it's neighborhood children. There are three children taken, dressed up, represent the Holy Family. and they are brought before the altar. It's on the whole, it's a private family celebration, so you open your house to the whole neighborhood, all your friends come and visit. It's done as a fulfilling a vow to, I went to a very fancy one place where the owner of the house was a mason, and he'd fallen off a third story building that he was working on. And before he got to the bottom, he had time to promise St. Joseph that if he didn't die, he would do an altar, and so he did. Anyway, these poor children are set there, and they're expected. The idea is that the family that's doing the altar is produces a huge feast. Somebody told me it had to be 99 different dishes. I don't think that is necessarily a rule. But the children are expected to take one bite out of each, and they start very happy and end up looking totally vicious, but anyway. So the children have taken the place of the poor, but one has remained unchanged are these altars. And actually nowadays, because you don't have to feed a lot of people, you can be much more, you can do just a little bit of a lot, and you get amazing spreads. The traditions change from town to town. I'm going to start with some photographs I took in these two towns, Vallelunga and Valledolmo, which are in the very center of Sicily. And these are just some of the altars that I've photographed there. And as you can see, there's a little bit of everything. There is fancy fruit, there's exotic fruit, tropical fruit, pineapples, oranges from here. You get, whoops, I went too fast. You get homemade pastries, you get store-bought pastries, you get fish, cheese, and in this, these are all, I guess, mostly homemade, and in this, aside that, this is a cake made to look like a frosted sheet cake, frosted to look like a theme park. You get a swimming pool and a zoo. I love that. But there are certain elements that appear to be mandatory, and that were in all of these different altars we looked at. Bread, citrus fruit, fennel and lettuce. Fennel and lettuce. Can't help thinking about those gardens of Adonis with fennel and lettuce. None of that sounds very far-fetched. Just wait a minute.
Rosemary?
Yeah, I think that's just a sprinkle.
The more
there's a nice Italian script, keep you now, keep you med. The more you got, the more you put, the more you add. So there's a lot of stuff in there that has no. And as far as I know, though, there is. But I'm not sure if it's true in. I guess it is true in Sicily. I'm trying to think back. That rosemary represents the Christ figure, because theoretically a rosemary plant only lasts 33 years, which is the age of Christ, of course. So the next town we're going to move from Vallelunga, Valledolmo to Salemi. Salemi is the most famous of the St. Joseph's Day festivals. Here are a few examples of this. This is the spread that those poor children then had to taste a little bit of each dish on that table, and you can imagine what they end up. I see sometimes they've been already organized in three little plates, three little servings of something or other. It's like strawberries and kiwi, I guess. These are some examples of the St. Joseph's Day altars from Salem. Of course, all this is all votive offerings. Amen. I guess I jumped ahead, but you can see they worked for weeks, and it's all in the hands of the women of the town. And there are the young women, and the not very adept women make these little ones. And then there are the main pieces, and some of them can be huge, that are made by women who sort of do it. Not, you know, professionally, and are very proud. 10 minutes. Let's go. Okay. So here are some more. Now, wait a minute. Do you see something here? There's that, and that, and that. Those are double angels. They're the gardens of Adonis, by. They are wheat that have been planted in little dishes and left. Right, but as an offering, the same. We're talking about harvests here. We're talking about propitiation. There's another one here, sticking up out there. The next photograph, which is really bad, and I apologize, but it's all I've got, and I think it's worth keeping, because that is all that what I did that was planted in a pine cone. It blew my mind when I saw it. And here you have fertility symbols to the ninth degree. I asked the woman of the house why she did it. It's pretty. Siusa. That's the way we do things. So, you know, so many of these rites have lost their original significance totally, but they're now still not going to do without them.
What date is St. Joseph's? Hmm? What is the date of St. Joseph's
festival? 19th of March. So this is a close-up of a Lavuredo. But this is probably not a garden prepared for St. Joseph's Day, because it's quite pale. The St. Joseph's Day Lavuretti are purely propitiatory. They're put in the sun. They get to be quite green wheat. This one is probably going to go to a church on Monday, Thursday, to do the Lavuretti on Monday, Thursday, Holy Thursday, the Thursday before Easter. There's the, what they do with the Pope, that is the Pope, to do the sepulchre. People visit, do a round of visiting to the different churches, and they've taken their lavuretti that they've prepared in the dark to offer. And as you can see, it's like a carpet, but what it is wheat, a very pale wheat that hasn't gotten properly green because it was growing in the. There's another one. Okay. I leave you to draw the connections. I think it's quite an amazing connection. And after all, of course, the connection between the whole story of the crucifixion and the resurrection of Christ and the various Middle Eastern gods of vegetation and rebirth, like Tammuz and Adonis, who died prematurely and then are reborn with the spring, has been pointed out a lot of times. But anyway, the importance of bread offerings, the whole connections in Easter are quite obvious. These are some of the bread things that are made at Easter. There's a town called San Biagio Platani, which shows what they call the Liarchi, the archers. And there's this huge part of the town is covered with arches that are all decorated. They're all made with sort of fake seeming chandeliers that are made out of dates and other vegetable matter strung up like beads. And then they're all decorated with panels of sculpted bread. And there's a procession there, much like the procession that John described yesterday, the Christ figure starting at one end the arch is there to do a sacred way along which this procession takes place, with the Christ figure at one end and the Madonna at the other, and then they meet. This is a ritual that's quite frequent in Sicily. And the year I went there, somebody had tied a couple of fava bean pods onto the wrist of the Christ. Any opportunity is good to propagate a good harvest. I just want to run through quickly some more things. I'm giving you a lot of bread, but you've probably eaten your full share already since you've been here. But one of my favorite festivals is a festival of Calatafimi. Well, Calatafimi is right near Segesta. It's the town near the temple of Segesta. It's celebrated every 6 years because it's a very expensive and elaborate festival. And there are big colonies of people from Calatafimi who come back from Australia for it, so they can't come to it every year. And it's in honor of the Holy Cross. It's the first days of May. This is a crucifix who was thought in the 17th century worked miracles, and they bring it out. In the 19th century, there was a period of considerable social unrest in Sicily, and the prefect of the province said, no procession this year, it's dangerous. The people went home, got their guns, and brought the Christ, the crucifix out under armed escort. And now, every year, the procession is opened by an escort of very marvelous looking Sicilian men with their lupada, with their shotguns. It's one of the sort of ex-Sicilian sites that I've ever seen here. And of course here too, it's bread we're talking about. This is a cart hung with bread. There are several feeds. Everybody wears bread, carries bread, throws bread to the street crowd. It's really quite amazing. But each guild, the fruit and vegetable growers, the cheese, the herd, the sheep shepherds, the cheese makers, each has their own little thing. And each one has a crico. There's a crico. Remember the description of the Avery Sonin, the olive branch, twisted with wool and hung with, which the young boy carried. This must be one of the shepherd guilds. The sort of, I think those are censers hanging from it. And the little animals that are stuck in between the bread, those are all made of cheese. And that's I think that belongs to the fruit and vegetable, the growers. Okay, and one last version of the Arizona, which is a Cavalcata dei Bestiamiali, which is a procession that takes place every 7 years in Gerasci Sicolo. And it's a procession made up of herdsmen, shepherds, and cowherders who are giving thanks for that. They feel that the whole Christian story of Christ has special attention for shepherds. They were the first to come to the manger. So, and there they are, in procession, looking absolutely gorgeous. And they are all carrying these aglicioni, decorated all with little animals made of caciocavallo cheese. It's amazing. I say you have to be lucky because it's every 7 years that they do it. I figured it out the other day that maybe it's going to be in 2018 they'll be doing it again. Although unfortunately, I don't think this place is a tourist attraction. Not many people know about it. The Casa de Fime thing has become a tourist attraction, and so they're accelerating and they're doing a little more often than they used to. But the important thing is that they keep doing it. Very quick.
How many minutes do you have? Two.
Okay, very quick. Some historical documented sources. This is an etching from an 18th century French painter, Robert Gouin, who was sent by the French king to document the ruins from life in Sicily. He spent 3 years traveling around Sicily, did an amazing collection of paintings, etchings, and text. He describes this. In the countryside around the city, Catania, after the harvest, the peasants celebrate a sort of orgy, a popular festival in thanksgiving for the good harvest. Young people open the procession, dancing in a circle. They are followed by a man on a donkey, beating a drum. 5 or 6 men mounted like him on this tranquil beast, follow in his footsteps, carrying long poles, decorated from top to bottom with little sheaves of wheat. In their midst, another man, equally well mounted, carries a large banner that floats majestically in the wind. A young woman dressed in white and seated on a donkey comes next. She is surrounded by men on foot who carry on their heads or in their arms sheaves of wheat, and they appear to do homage to her. A crowd of country people follows this cortege playing on different musical instruments. The better educated people in Catania have assured me that this is a very ancient custom, of which they do not know the origins, but they have no doubt that it is the remains of the ancient feasts of Demeter, and that the young woman represents the goddess to whom they offer their harvest in order to maintain her benevolence. One last place, Ayrton. I think the people of London, where you go, you get to Ayrton? Yes. Ayrton is a mountain, it's on the top of a mountain that rises very abruptly from the sea just over the city of Tripoli. And it is myth-ridden. Mount Eryx is said to be named after a beekeeper whom Aphrodite was in love with. It's one of the oldest sacred spots in the Mediterranean. It was the site of the cult of the Great Mother and then of the Carthaginian Astarte, the Phoenician Astarte, and then Aphrodite, and then Venus Erycina, in whose temple, and the only place in the Western Empire where sacred prostitution was allowed. Nowadays it's a little medieval town, very pretty. Unusual in that this cathedral, what was a cathedral, the main church, is not on the main square, as it usually happens in Italian towns, but it's right inside the front gate of the town. And it was built there, it said, to catch the women who were on their way to the temple site, to offer bring offerings to the site, and there's now a castle around it, the site of the temple to Aphrodite, so that in order that the goddess would help them become pregnant. And so they, as they came to the gate, the priest was standing there, the Madonna will do very well, thank you. You're going to have to go all the way to the temple site. Doesn't very effective, so much so that in the 16th century, there are church documents fussing, complaining about all the comings and goings to the temple site. And very conveniently, a goddess, a ship carrying an image of a painting of the Madonna went ashore in a tempest just below the mountain. And the sailors thought that they'd been miraculously saved by the picture, and they built a chapel, and that became the Madonna di Custonaci, who replaced Aphrodite, more or less. The pastry chef that I wrote a book with, who grew up in an orphanage in Ayrton, run by nuns, said that when in the post-war years, very, very in dire poverty, they used to make a very simple little biscuit for the people who couldn't afford anything better to sell to offer at their wedding vests. And these biscuits were called Idvinis, it's a Slavic name, small. Niloi, Milivni, no, I'll leave it to you. But I think Aphrodite is still up there somewhere. Thank you very much.